So, you know, I'm working my way through the last three prophets of the Old Testament this winter. These are the last words of the Old Testament. Always good to pay attention to last words, adds that element. The last thing that's going to be said, the last thing that's going to be, you know, that last, because what happens after Malachi, you got Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, all contemporaries about the same time, sitting on a park bench talking about things, right? You just picture that somewhere around Jerusalem, watching the wall get reconstructed, or the temple get reconstructed. But, you know, they're saying, for when Malachi's done, 400 years of silence. God's like, okay, I'm done. I'm out. You know, how does that happen? How does it happen after all that they went through? How does that, you know, next thing's going to happen is John the Baptist going to show up on the scene. After 400 years of silence, John the Baptist, he shows up baptizing people, talking about Jesus coming. Then the next thing you know, Jesus shows up, and they rejected him. I mean, they didn't just, okay, you know, just speak to the hand because the head's not listening. It was like, okay, you're done, you're dead. How do they miss the message of their Messiah? How did that happen? I mean, was God through the prophets, these prophets, others, was he not clear? Well, you be the judge. Let's talk about that today. I'm going to start today talking about those times in our lives where we have the ultimate amount of optimism. You know, certain times in our lives when just everything is rosy, everything looks good, everything's positive, right? Springtime. Springtime. I love springtime. You know why? Because pitchers and catchers report next week. I mean, okay, football season, okay, football season. It's done. Something got to occupy our time, right? And it gets this time of year, growing up in the Midwest, right, playing baseball in the Midwest, I can still smell it. I can still smell the leather of my glove. I can still smell the weeds that have popped out, the pollens, and start sneezing if I try hard enough. You know, you can feel it. You can just sense it, you know. And in a spring training, everybody is optimistic because everybody's in the hunt for the World Series. Right? I mean, just nobody's lost a game yet. And this year particularly, the Diamondbacks picked up a couple of players. And word is they're going to challenge the Dodgers for the West, maybe even a wild card. We could see postseason baseball again here in the neighborhood. And everybody's feeling good about things. Everybody's healthy. They've healed from last year. You okay? So you know what happens at the end of March, though, right? Opening day. And then the reality of a 162-game season over 6 months sets in. Nobody promised anybody the World Series. They got to go out and earn it. And 162 games. Oh, that's hard. But, hey, we're optimistic now, right? You remember when you graduated? High school, maybe, college, grad school, whatever. You remember you graduated? Your career is right there in front of you. You got this picture of where you're going to go, what you're going to just accomplish, top of your field. You're going to be, you know, the world is laying out there. They are going to come. They're going to be the path to your feet to hire you. You're going to make it to the top of your field. You're going to be the boss. I told you, I've always dreamt of being the pastor of the largest church in town. Hey, 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 you know. Every time I say that, people outside, well, how many churches are there in town? Don't ask that question. Seriously? You know, so, okay, school's out, and you've started your career, and somewhere along the line, reality sets in, doesn't it? Might have been that boss or that coworker, could have been the economy. Maybe the job was just harder than you expected it to be. You know, whatever, somewhere along the line, that hope that you had, that reality you ran into took your hope away. And you're just trying now to survive, hang on till you retire. And for those of us in the room who maybe got a little less tread on our tires, when did you first realize you're not going to live forever? Was it your 40th birthday? Was it your 50th birthday? 60? Hasn't happened yet. Maybe for some it hadn't happened yet. That's entirely possible, right? But you know, you're just flowing because when you're 18, 25, 30, what are you going to? You're going to live forever. Man, you know, you're playing hard. You're working hard. Optimism. Everything's going wonderfully. Then somewhere along the line, something breaks. Something breaks down. Or it happens to someone close to you. And then reality, that reality begins to take the hope, the notion that, you know, well, you know, old age is hard. Or speaking of retirement, you remember when you started investing in your retirement and you did the math and found out what compounding interest would do? Man, those last 10, 12 years, you're just, man, it's you're just socking it away, loading up. And you see what's going to happen. And if you just start now as a 25-year-old, you got 40 years. In 40 years, you're going to be a millionaire. The lifestyle, the travel, no responsibilities, a house in Munn's Park, a house wherever. It's going to, you know, and then reality sets in. Can't quite make all those deposits in your retirement, or maybe you couldn't max it out like you were sold that investment plan, or maybe you had to make a withdrawal along the way because kids got college, and or the market, maybe the market just didn't work out, you know, your investments, whatever it is. But you know, now you can't retire like you thought you could, and it's beginning to take your hope because you're working, and it's hard. How about marriage? You remember when you first got married? Oh, the honeymoon, just silly, stupid in love. You know, I mean, your parents didn't have a perfect marriage, right? You know, you saw your parents, not perfect. But hey, this is you. You're going to correct all the mistakes they made. Your marriage is going to be different. Yeah, we were all there, right? Then the honeymoon ends and reality sets in. Now, you both made promises, till death do us part, in sickness and in health, for better or for worse, richer or for poorer. Marriage is hard. Even the best marriage. I think Sarah and I got one of the best ones going, but, you know, we have those moments. It's hard. You know, and you start out so hopeful. Or when you had your first kid. You remember holding your first kid? I still remember. Alyssa was born in April of 89. I can still remember in the hospital room there holding her, thinking how excited I was. I'm a dad. I got a little girl. You know, a couple of sons followed. But, you know, just the optimism of how, look, you know, again, my parents weren't perfect. We're going to correct those mistakes, and we're going to be different. You know, our kids, we're going to be the cool parents. All my kids' friends are going to want to hang out at our house. We're going to do the games, be the coach, all the activities. You know, and how many times you catch yourself saying, boy, these, you know, because you talk about your friends. Okay, I don't, Sarah and I talked about our friends, and we never talk about you, trust me. But you talk about your friends, and you see their kid, and you think, oh, they better get that kid under control now. He is going to be trouble. And then your kid gets in trouble. So what happened to the hope of having the perfect kid and the perfect family? Reality is hard because parenting is hard work. And nobody promised it would be easier, that your kids would turn out no matter how much hard work you put in. I remember when I first met Jesus. I was 17 years old. August the 17th, 1977, I was 17 years old. And that night, I remember laying in bed, something was different. I was alive. There was an excitement and energy. I felt the hope and optimism. I was a junior in high school, still had my senior year to go, but all of a sudden, career came into focus, a reason to go to college, what I wanted to do. When I was in college, I volunteered in a college ministry while I was going to class, you know, filled with hope and excitement, what my career would be like. I remember talking to my best friend at the time. He had already planned, in college, he was on his way to seminary, and I was thinking, you know, I just don't see seminary in my future. I think I'm going to be that business guy, and I'll be your elder, your board member. Funny how things turn out, right? You know, as someone new to my faith, I, like so many of us, I had the idea that God would make things easier for me. Because you know the old saying, God never gives you anything you can't handle. And if you've been around here any length of time at all, you know I've debunked that repeatedly. God always gives us more than you can handle. The point of asking for help, we recognize our limits. He does. The new reality of knowing Jesus made me hope, but the old reality that life is hard still tried to take away my hope. Here's where we're going today. God's reality will make you hope when your reality tries to take your hope. Don't lose hope. Don't lose your hope. This is where Israel was when these prophets wrote. They'd come into the promised land that first time. They were filled with tremendous hope. The wandering in the wilderness had ended. Okay, there were 2 million funerals. Distant memory, minor setback. They're there now, right? They arrived. Something I said last week to keep in mind, we can't mess up God's plan. We can only mess up our lives. God's plan all along was for Israel to end up in the promised land, and they did, just not the first generation. First generation in the wilderness messed things up pretty bad, and they didn't get to enter into the promised land. But God's plan continued to be carried out. Joshua led the next generation in. Tremendous optimism. The future, the promises. But then reality set in, of the hard reality of living in a land that had been dominated by foreign gods, combined then with the arrogance of Israel, kind of let it go to their heads that they were special. God made them special. Now they're back, and they're struggling, mired in poverty. The wealth that they had was gone. Oh, for the good old days. We catch ourselves thinking about that. Oh, the good old days. Churches are famous for that. But here they are now. They're paying taxes to the Persian king. They aren't even ruling themselves in this case. But, okay, they're back in the promised land. And God had promised a bright future, but was it true? Would they get it? Would they be able to keep their hope and joy until they got it? And how would they get it? That's the subject of visions 3 and 4 from Zechariah. Now, you remember I laid out the outline of Zechariah last week, the first major section of Zechariah, 8 visions. So I talked about the first two last week. This week I'm talking about the next two visions that he has. He has 8 visions all on the same night. I struggle to remember one dream. He had 8, remembered all of them, wrote them all down. Chapters 2 and 3 of Zechariah are visions 3 and 4, and vision number 3 gives them reason, gives Israel reason for hope. Vision number 3, the reason for hope. Let me read chapter 2, Zechariah chapter 2, all 13 verses. Then I looked up, and there before me was a man with a measuring line in his hand, and I asked, "Where are you going?" He answered me, "To measure Jerusalem, to find out how wide and how long it is." While the angel was speaking, who was speaking to me, was leaving, another angel came in to meet him and said to him, "Run and tell that young man, Jerusalem will be a city without walls because the great number of people and animals in it. And I myself will be a wall of fire around it, declares the Lord, and I will be its glory within. Come, come, flee from the land of the north, declares the Lord, for I have scattered you to the four winds of heaven, declares the Lord. Come, Zion, escape you who live in daughter Babylon, for this is what the Lord Almighty says. After the Glorious One has sent me against the nations that have plundered you, for whoever touches you touches the apple of his eye. I will surely raise my hand against them so that their slaves will plunder them. Then you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent me. Shout and be glad, daughter Zion, for I am coming and I will live among you, declares the Lord. Many nations will be joined with the Lord in that day and will become my people. I will live among you and you will know that the Lord Almighty has sent me to you. The Lord will inherit Judah as his portion in the Holy Land and will again choose Jerusalem. Be still before the Lord, all mankind, because he has roused himself from his holy dwelling." It's a picture. It's a dream. Fairly simple. The vision itself is a picture of a surveyor who's marking the boundaries of Jerusalem, measuring its area. How many people could fit inside Jerusalem? That's what he's looking for. How many people could fit? Measuring the boundaries. We can clearly see the four walls in this room. We measure the boundaries in this room. Fire marshal has something to say about how many people could fit in this room. You know how many people that is? 216. Little plaque on the wall out there in the lobby says that's how many people. We have 201 of these blue-green chairs. We always keep them summertime. We got about 20 in the choir loft, 181 out here. We'll set up a few folding chairs. So we get right there. But that's what these walls will hold, according to our fire marshal. We see these walls. Get a laser measure. I mean, if you're modern, you got a laser measure. If you're old-fashioned, get your tape measure. You know your phones. My phone has a measuring little app on it too. I can measure things. It's just, if you're, of course, I don't know how accurate it is, But you know how many people per square feet? Israel couldn't see their boundaries because the wall had been destroyed. And the point is, there will be so many people, so many animals, they won't fit within the boundaries one day. They're just a small little group that had returned amongst the rubble, and they're struggling because they're poor. But someday, Jerusalem will be so prosperous in the future that their current situation and poverty will be a distant memory. So many people, so much commerce, so much wealth, so blessed by God beyond measure, beyond the measuring of the surveyor, beyond measure, will be their blessing from God. One of the characteristics of Old Testament prophecy is there can be multiple partial fulfillments on the way to the final complete fulfillment. Partial fulfillments encourage the people that the grand finale is coming. Just hang on, keep walking, hang on to the hope that you have. So the vision is both near future and distant future fulfillment. I'll get into that more in just a minute. But no matter how hard life may be at the time, just keep moving. The future is bright. Keep walking. Everything is going to work out. The angel expressed the urgency for Zechariah to communicate to Israel because they're struggling. They'd been back for 20-some years, and it's still just not coming together. Life is hard. The reality of their reestablishment in the promised land is beginning to take their hope, and they're losing it. But they need to know God's reality so it can make them hang on to their hope. Jerusalem was going to be rebuilt. We know it was because Nehemiah wrote that it was. We read Nehemiah, see, they rebuilt everything. God promised, and it was going to happen. Not only did they build the wall around the city, but the area outside the wall was densely populated. But this vision didn't just point to Nehemiah's rebuild. If they thought his rebuild was encouraging, wait till they see the rebuild in the end. The clue in the text that this is about the end times are the terms daughter Babylon and daughter Zion. We're talking, he was writing about future generations, a future generation of the current cities. Not the city then, not even the city now of this day. All the scattered Jews and all the believers around the world will come and establish residence in the New Jerusalem. And the walls will not be able to contain them. There's something encouraging when people come and join you. Isn't there in a church? Don't you love it when people come in and join us? When a new couple, new family come in, it's encouraging. They bring soup to our Super Bowl. They plug in and worship with us. They hang out and they do things with us. We all love it when people agree and come and join and participate. Israel was being criticized, persecuted for what they believe, but there will be a large group that agrees and will join them in their homeland at some point. The entire city will rejoice. The entire city will rejoice, just like Kansas City last week. Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri. It's okay. Not so for the people in old Babylon or even the new Babylon, because Israel was poor. No military, no money, but the desire for revenge would have been strong. What they wouldn't give to pay Babylon back for what they did to them. But they could do nothing but wish for revenge. The desire for revenge will suck the joy out of you. Somebody does you wrong, somebody hurts you, somebody hurts somebody you love, that desire to get even will just suck whatever joy, whatever hope you have. But they could let it go. They didn't have to hang on to their desire to get even because God was going to handle it. Babylon had enslaved Israel, just like the Egyptians had. And when Israel left Egypt, God arranged so that they plundered Egypt's wealth when they left. They walked out with everything they had. He'll do the same when he establishes the New Jerusalem. Those who once were enslaved by Babylon will plunder them. The entire wealth of the world will be possessed by those who live in the kingdom. Babylon and the rest of the world should be warned. You mess with God's people, you're messing with God. And you mess with God, he's going to mess with you. It's not going to go well. It's freeing to let God handle those who've hurt you or who've hurt the people you love. You've heard it said that holding a grudge is like taking poison, hoping the other guy dies, right? Yeah, that's truth there. It's just going to kill you. It kills you. It kills your relationships. It kills your life. It destroys everything inside of you. But we can forgive because we have confidence that God is making things right better than we ever could. His way, His time, all good. Then, like in the Garden of Eden, the New Jerusalem, God will walk among us. His presence right there. And we are in His presence. When we're in His presence, we experience everything He offers. Life, peace, joy, patience, kindness, love, self-control, all those things in His presence, right? He has so much. He possesses so much. He can't even contain it. It spills out on us. His presence, it's personal. It's intimate. Is there someone you know in your life, when they walk into a room, everybody just gets caught up in their personality? Could be joy, could be anger. Optimism could be pessimism. You know that strength of personality. People just conform, right? Well, that's God. When He walks into a room, into your presence, everybody just conforms. He emits it. It oozes. He oozes life. And when you're that close, it gets all over you, just like when you're feeding that baby in the high chair. Here comes the airplane. Open up. Kid takes a bite and then sneezes. What happens? I don't know if God sneezes or not, but, you know, you just can't help but get sprayed. The kingdom will be filled with people from every nation, and we will all join together and live in the same neighborhood. There will be no side of the tracks. And our shouts for joy will transition into awe-inspired silence in the presence of God as He has fulfilled His promise to rebuild, repopulate, and reprosper. And when He does, we will be blessed beyond measure, beyond the measurement of the surveyor in vision number 3. No wall can contain them, but a wall won't even be needed because God will be the defender of the people at that time. That's the hope that they had. That's the hope that we have. No matter how bad things may be right now, and you know, I understand they can get bad. They may break for you soon. They may not. But long term, you will live like a king or a queen in the kingdom because you're going to be hanging out with the king. How do we get there? I mean, there's the million-dollar question right there, huh? If all this is possible, how do we make it happen? This should be the focus of everything in our lives right now. This should be number one. Whatever's going on here, remember, your life expectancy is what, 80-some? You know, maybe you're pushing 90? Beyond that, beyond what is forever? It's okay, whatever goes on in this life, it's forever we want to go well. That should be the focus of everything we have here. Our lives should be dedicated to getting this, our highest priority. But how? How can we be assured of being part of it and experience everything God promised? How do we make our reservation for a place in the kingdom? It's vision number 4, chapter 3, making a reservation for hope. Let me read chapter 3 to you, 10 verses. Then he showed me Joshua the high priest standing before the angel of the Lord and Satan standing at his right side to accuse him. The Lord said to Satan, "The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord who has chosen Jerusalem rebuke you. Is not this man a burning stick snatched from the fire?" Now Joshua was dressed in filthy clothes as he stood before the angel. The angel said to those who were standing before him, "Take off his filthy clothes." Then he said to Joshua, "See, I have taken away your sin, and I will put fine garments on you." Then I said, "Put a clean turban on his head. Finish the deal." So they put a clean turban on his head and clothed him while the angel of the Lord stood by. The angel of the Lord gave this charge to Joshua. "This is what the Lord Almighty says. If you will walk in obedience to me and keep my requirements, then you will govern my house and have charge of my courts, and I will give you a place among these standing here. Listen, High Priest Joshua, you and your associates seated before you, who are men symbolic of things to come. I am going to bring my servant the branch. See the stone I have set in front of Joshua? There are 7 eyes on that one stone, and I will engrave an inscription on it, says the Lord Almighty, and I will remove the sin of this land in a single day. In that day, each of you will invite your neighbor to sit under your vine and fig tree, declares the Lord Almighty. Again, that's vision number four. A little more complex, but still fairly simple. There's Joshua, the high priest. He recognized him. You guys have dreams about people you know? You know, you recognized him, right? Incorporated in the vision. This is Joshua the priest. But then there was Satan too, and he knew who he was. Anybody seen him, somehow he knew he was there. But then an angel and a group standing nearby. And Joshua was dressed in nasty, nasty clothes. The Hebrew word for that filth, that word filth, human waste. Human waste. Can you think of anything nastier? I mean, maybe you've been places, but, you know, we're talking just smeared, stained, just wretched, reeking. See, that's the residue of our sin that offends God's nostrils. And here's Joshua standing in it. Now, you know, I can't think of much worse, but I can think of one thing that's pretty bad, and that's dog waste. Know something about that, little something. I know I've told this story before, but it fits here. It fits here, right? This isn't Jack. This goes back a couple of dog generations in our family. But my two boys were 7 and 9. You know, they're adults on their own now. But if you remember the story, my boys were 7 and 9, and we rolled around springtime. It was a beautiful spring Sunday afternoon after church. Wintertime was over. The boys' chores, as you recall, was to clean up after the dogs in the backyard. We're living in Indiana, had a nice big lot. Their job was to go out and clean up, you know, and take the shovel. We had a trash can back there that they'd put the dog waste in all summer long. Of course, all winter long. We do it summertime, but all winter long. And it would snow, you know, couldn't find it, so wait for the snow to melt. They'd clean up again, and it would snow. Well, somewhere along the lines they're doing this, one of the boys did not get the lid on the trash can. And it snowed, and it snowed, and it melted in the trash can. And somewhere along the line, the trash bag dropped into the trash can too. Oh, goodness. All winter long. Now, okay, being the good dad that I was, teaching my boys responsibility, they created the mess. They needed to clean up the mess. So you know what I did? I set them up on the front driveway with that nasty, you know, can, and, you know, gave them a shovel, extra trash bags, and, you know, kind of gave them some basic instructions. And again, beautiful, you know, spring Sunday afternoon. And somewhere along the line, they decided to get the hose involved and add more water. And that beautiful spring Sunday afternoon in May was also happened to be Mother's Day. Sarah could have killed me. Not one of my finer moments. The stench in the neighborhood was horrendous. Neighbors next door were having a party on their back deck. They had to go inside. We heard other neighbors slamming their windows. You know, again, beautiful day. You want the fresh air in. I cannot explain to you the offense to your nostrils. Our boys were covered in it. In their hair, on their clothes. I mean, oh, Sarah was mad. I'm so glad she's not here today because she'd give me the look again. They were filthy, nasty. But here's the point. Joshua was nastier. Human waste is far worse than dog waste. He was as good as dead. He was as good as dead, like a well-seasoned dry stick in your fireplace. And God pulled him out, saved from the fire, only to be accused by Satan of the obvious nastiness, not worthy of God's attention. It's just the obvious. Satan stood there accusing him, making him feel guilty, unworthy. Look, smell that. He's not worthy of you. Nothing that nasty gets into the presence of God, right? And yet God cleaned him up anyway. Joshua didn't do anything to deserve it. Just grace and mercy prompted God to clean him up and change his appearance. Yeah, he's unworthy. Yes, he should feel guilty. And God did it anyway and took it all away. He cleaned him up unconditionally and then gave him a job to do conditionally. The job had three parts and it was conditioned on something. The condition was, keep my commands. Okay, again, a reminder, folks. Ten commandments. What's command number one? You should have no other gods before me. Jesus was asked, what are the two most important commandments, which are also listed in the Old Testament? What's the most important commandment? You shall love the Lord your God with all your mind, heart, soul, and strength. Number two, love your neighbor yourself. So if you'll just, that's those Old Testament as well as New. So Joshua, if you'll just do those two things, keep my commandments, then you get these three jobs. Part one, govern my house. That is, you'll have a gifted and empowered service to perform in the temple. Part two, you'll have charge over my courts. That is, you'll guard the truth and prevent lies from misleading people. Part number three, you'll have a place among the standing. That is, those standing in the temple courtyard in the presence of God, he will have access and be able to boldly and confidently enter into God's presence. Keep the command, he gets a job, got those three parts. According to the vision, how is God going to facilitate all this? Well, one day he's going to bring his branch. And in your Bibles, that word branch is capitalized because that's a reference to David's line and the promise that a descendant of David's will sit on the throne as king, that is Messiah. The stick will be pulled out of the fire and grafted into the branch of David, and it will sprout life. That dead, dry branch will sprout to life. Then he says there's a stone in front of him. The stone has seven eyes and an etched message on it. The stone will be a stumbling stone for those who refuse to believe and refuse to surrender their lives to the king. But it will be the chief cornerstone to those who do believe, the foundation, security, strength, stability for life for those who do surrender to him and accept him. Seven eyes. Seven is the number that represents God in prophecy. Those are God's eyes. Eyes provide both input and output. The eyes are the windows of the soul, allowing people to see the character inside. You know what that's like? You look into somebody's eyes, you can tell something about what's going on inside of them. You can tell them they're sad, they're stressed, they're happy. You look into their eyes, you can see things that will reveal things about their character. But eyes also let things in. As they see the character, the eyes will bring the character and the heart of those nearby. God will make himself known and know the condition of the hearts of everyone in the world. And the etching, it was custom in the day that they would etch the name of the owner, builder, and the purpose of the building on the cornerstone. You'd walk up to a building, find the cornerstone, it would tell you who owns it, who built it, and the purpose of the building. Whatever it was there for. It's a hospital, it's a school, this is so-and-so's house. And everybody was an owner builder. Everybody built their own buildings. Everybody built their own house. Well, the Messiah is the owner builder of the temple. Its purpose is the dwelling place of God. And in one single day, God will remove all of the sin and the guilt from the land, so no one stands before him in their filth anymore. In one day. And of course, they're thinking, they're looking ahead. How in one act, in one day, could God possibly remove all of the sin from the past, from the present, from the future? I mean, we all know what we get involved in. We all know how imperfect we really are. Now, multiply that times everybody on the earth right now. Everybody's been on the earth. Everybody's going to be on the earth. And in one day, in one act, God is going to remove the sin and the guilt. Yeah, Joshua was filthy, unworthy, guilty, and God removed it all in a flash. That's the vision that Zechariah took to the people. It was for anyone who was as good as dead but wanted to live. You want to live? Look, you know. You know inside right now if you're alive or not. You know. And for anybody who's not, you're that stick in the fire, and you want God to drag you out, and you want to be grafted into the branch. You know, nobody needs to tell you that. Those people who knew they were filthy, unworthy, guilty, they were sick and tired of it. They were given the promise that in the distant future they would be blessed beyond measure. They would be a part of a populated kingdom where God himself walks openly throughout all eternity. Now you may say, wait a minute, that's Old Testament. That's Zechariah. What about us? Well, what about us? Romans 3:23, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Romans 6:23, the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life through Jesus Christ our Lord. We're all as good as dead. We start out as good as dead, sticks in the fire, just getting all singed up. But God pulled us out, and we stand before him in the nastiness of our sin, but it was by grace and mercy. Ephesians 2:8-9, for by grace you've been saved. Through faith. This is not from yourselves. It's the gift of God, not by works that anyone can boast and brag about how good they are. You didn't pull yourself out of that fire. And if you're still in it, you can't pull yourself out of that fire. And we have an accuser. Revelation 12:10. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, now have come the salvation and power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Messiah, for the accuser of our brothers and sisters who accuses them before our God day and night has been hurled down. Watch out, earth. Satan was called out for his attempt to take over, and now he's ticked off. And he's pointing out every bit of filth in our lives. Scorched earth. He can't win, so he's doing his best to make sure as few people as possible get to live where he can't anymore. He's pointing out to God that we are not worthy of the life that he offers, making sure we feel the guilt. Pointing out every little thing. You know that thing you did? That thing you said maybe it was 10 years ago, but it's still there. You got that picture, and Satan is pointing it out that you are not worthy of what God has done for you. Romans 5:8, but God demonstrates his own love for us in this. While we were still sinners, Jesus died for us. He didn't wait for us to change our own clothes, didn't wait for us to clean up our act, didn't wait for us to make positive changes. We are on fire and filthy, and he died for us in that moment. Filthy, nasty, guilty, and he changed our clothes. He changed our appearance. When the Holy Spirit came in, he baptized us and changed the way we look to God from filthy rags to white as snow. And we can boldly, confidently enter into the presence of God. Hebrews 4:16, let us then approach God's throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. Boldly, confidently into the presence of God. And we've been saved for a purpose, Ephesians 2:10. For we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which he prepared in advance for us to do. Gifted and empowered service in the temple of God that is now the church. That is the church, guarding the truth with free access to God once the curtain was torn in two. Don't let the difficult circumstances of your reality in your life steal your joy by taking away your hope. Focus on God's reality for your life and let it make you hope, because you know your future is secure and your reservation is set for all of eternity in his repopulated kingdom, where his blessings will spill out all over you, just like that kid that sneezes on you. You're gonna get it. That's visions 3 and 4 in the Old Testament, Zechariah. Little application, as always. Let me give you a few possibilities. First, think about your wealth. Think about your wealth. Be content with what you have here. Do not chase wealth that you'll leave behind when you're gone and will eventually burn up anyway. All the wealth of the world will be available to everybody who lives in the New Jerusalem forever. Don't get hung up on this life about what you don't have, what you wish you had, and end up fighting and chasing and doing the wrong things to get it. Just hang on. One day, you'll have access to all the wealth in the world. Stop chasing wealth and learn to be content. Just choose today to be content. Second, forgive. So, is there somebody right now that you catch yourself dreaming about from time to time, getting hurt as bad as they hurt you? Or as bad as they hurt somebody you love? Talk to parents whose kids end up going through a divorce, getting treated poorly. Are you drinking that poison, expecting that person to get sick? Let God have it. Just choose right now, today. God, you got this one. Let him have it. Let God have whatever desire you have for get even. We got fairness in our genes. Something about the way we live our lives. We just want to be fair. Just be fair. This for that. Let's make it even. Right. And if I get hurt, you got to get hurt. Same amount, same way. Right? We feel we have been hurt unfairly. Then it's natural. It is natural to pursue getting even. That's fair. What I'm asking this morning to do is to do the unnatural thing. The supernatural thing. Let God get even. Let God have it. If someone hurt one of God's people, including you, then they hurt God. He will handle it better than you ever could. And trust me when I tell you, he's handling it right now. You don't know what's going on inside of these people. Rest assured, he's got it. Let it go this morning. Just let it go. And Satan will try and bring it back to you. Let it go again. He'll try and bring it back. Let it go again. Finally, stand accused. Yeah, you stand accused. Okay, you sit here accused. I'm standing. We have an accuser. Our accuser is as real and as alive as Jesus himself is. Don't kid yourself. Satan is not dead. That's a big lie. And one of the things he does is he will constantly bring back to mind those things that you've done wrong. Plus a few. Maybe they weren't even that bad. And he's going to try to make you feel so guilty that you can't love your husband. That you can't be a good parent. That you don't think you're worth having a ministry in the church. You may as well just fold up your tent, pack it in, and, you know, go out in the forest and blow your head off. That's what he wants you to do. Some of us don't even need an accuser, though. We're too good at accusing ourselves, pointing out our flaws, and hanging on to things we've done wrong all of our lives. Whether it's Satan or you or some combination, okay, no, you're not worthy of the life God offers. But he gives it to you anyway. You're alive. He offered it. He's given it to you anyway. Because he loves you so much, and he thinks you're so incredibly valuable. Remember, a thing is worth what somebody else will pay for it. You may think your house is worth $1 million, but if you only get somebody to pay you $10, that's what it's worth. What did Jesus pay for you? His life. That means your life is worth the life of God. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Don't let anybody, including Satan, accuse you, make you believe you're worth any less than the life of Jesus himself. One of the hardest things you may ever do in your life is have to forgive yourself. Let it go. Because God will get even with you as necessary. And when he does it, it's right and it's good. Jesus has taken it away. Don't believe the lies that you need to hang on to it. Let the guilt go. That is hope and joy. God's reality will make you hope when your reality tries to take your hope. Don't let it take your hope. That's